Good evening, sir. Eric, relatively new? I haven't seen your face before.
Hey, how's it going? Been around for a while. I've been working with Andrew for a couple of years now. Not often I have Wednesday afternoon available, so try and get on as many of these as I can.
Nice. That's cool to hear. Any questions throughout this, don't hesitate to speak up or ask anything.
Thank you.
Shaws, how are you?
I'm doing well, man. Thank you. How are you doing?
I'm good.
Where's the gift?
Again, haven't seen your face before. Are new?
I am new. Yeah, I'm about a month in. I've been working with Andrew for about a month now. So,
Oh, awesome. Loads of Andrew's clients. Because Robert, you're Andrew's client as well, aren't you?
indeed.
Yeah. The crew representing.
Right. Mine was a simple allocation. I think they're like, you're tall and have lots of kids. Like, work with Andrew. It's the same.
Hey, Paul, how are you?
Doing well, how are you?
I'm very good, thank you. Nice to see you, John. Good.
Hi,
Afternoon.
Greg. Happy midnight to you.
Not quite midnight yet. It's getting there. It's 5 past 11.
Okay, so happy 11 o'clock to you.
We're getting close. Henry, what's going on?
Nothing much, man. Just another beautiful day in North Carolina, so can't complain.
Yeah, man. East Coast can't be too bad. Austin, I see you're in the background. Okay, as we wait to see if anyone else shows up, has anybody got any wins from the previous week that they want to disclose? Anyone hit new targets, new goals, new lifts? No?
I've got.
Go, Shaz.
Oh yeah, no, I was just saying I just started a new block and we're going into more strength-based training, so that's been going well. I always enjoy that, so yeah, that's been one win for me so far this week.
Big win. Fuck high reps. It's all about strength work.
Absolutely.
Oh,
Bringing in the Southern Hemisphere, Greg, so just getting back into waking up with some light and working out while there's daylight around me and walking to the gym without a jacket on. That's my win. It's just a happier time. The sun, warm.
you saying that to rub it in to all of us in the Northern Hemisphere
Hey,
as it begins to creep into winter?
vice versa, right?
It's not so long ago. It's only the last few weeks now that I've started to wake up again, and it's dark. It's grim. But yeah, no, winter doesn't bother me too much. But man, yeah, it'd be nice. When does it get proper hot for you? Because you're a little bit more central, right?
Yeah, I'm inland a bit, so we don't get the, well, we get sort of the, not as crazy as the western part of the country, but probably not until like December. Then we're into, high 30, 40 Celsius, over 100 Fahrenheit.
Yeah, still gets proper hot.
Yeah, it's sort of like heat wave in Europe where people start dying. But for
Yeah.
us, it's just like a nice summer day.
It's just standard. So like what kind of weather would you guys be getting now?
So again, Canberra, because I'm inland, so don't get the same coastal effect. So cool in the morning still, like 9, 10 degrees Celsius, and then up to 20 is like just that really nice clear blue skies, t-shirt weather during the day, maybe light jumper on the morning.
Perfect weather. That's perfect. Nice. Anybody else got any wins that they want to celebrate for over the last week, last month? It doesn't necessarily have to be the last few days.
I pushed my weight up on a few lifts, and I finished the first day of an online seminar on movement assessment today.
Nice. Nice work, John. Yeah, you're just getting stronger most weeks now, which is cool to see. So yeah, John, you're smashing it. That's great. They're good wins. So today, guys, we're going to touch on cardiovascular disease. I know it's a really broad subject. So I wanted to touch on slightly more around some of the mechanisms that some of you guys may not know that plays into it. So we will touch on things like genetics and stuff today in regards to cardiovascular disease, but we'll also touch on some of the other mechanisms that seem to play a role that people often neglect. So we know all the standardized things. We know about smoking, we know about sedentary lifestyle and Western diet and all these things that lead into cardiovascular disease. But why then do we still get people who drop dead from heart attacks at 50 who follow quote unquote healthy lifestyles? There is underlying mechanisms that play into that, and there's things that we can keep an eye on as individuals and as a group. We can start to try and assess these things early. And it's especially with cardiovascular disease with men, it's the thing that's most likely going to kill us. We don't tend to, in the same amounts, die of cancer. That tends to be, we don't tend to, we almost triple the amount of men will die of cardiovascular disease than they will of cancer. So, if, as we know, that's in such high levels, I wanted to touch on some of that stuff today. So, I'll come in and out of the presentation to make sure I can interact with you guys. Has anybody ever here, I don't think from anyone in the room, but I'll ask the question anyway. Has anyone here actually ever had a cardiac event?
Me.
John, go.
I had a heart attack 16 years ago. It'll be 16 years in January. It's one of my big motivating factors for staying as active as I do. I want to keep my heart healthy and be around as long as I can.
Because you're how old now, John?
I'm 70. So I
In
had the
good
heart
shape.
attack when I was 54.
Yeah. And you're in good shape now for 70. You're in good shape for any age. And did they figure, so main reason for a cardiac event or heart attack? Did they ever tell you?
Well, I have stents in two arteries because I have two blocked arteries. My husband was actually happy I had the heart attack when I did because of the blocked arteries. It was kind of triggered by stress, but he said that if it had gone on longer, I might be dead. So we're thankful I had it when I did.
And for this is so it's important to note with stuff like this, for most of us, we don't have to wait on a cardiac event to signal that we have some sort of blockage, right? 15, 16 years ago, the availability of testing wasn't there and the knowledge wasn't there in regards to it. So looking at all the underlying factors will normally determine that we don't actually have to have that a cardiac event before anything happens. Does anybody have history of cardiovascular disease in their family that concerns them? John? Nobody else? Okay. Now, as we go down through this, like I said, I'll come in and out of this presentation, so that you guys can ask questions. I'll try and pull you guys in a little bit more if I can as well. So today we're going to go through, let me just share this full screen. Ooh. Not sure. I've done this a thousand times and now I can't actually remember how to share a full screen. Share design, where's present? Hold on, I'll come back to this in a second. Okay, so one more question before I can actually get that up onto full screen presenting. How many of you guys actually know your blood pressure? And if you do, can you just chuck it down in the group? That's something that I will be asking you guys later. So if you know standardly what it is on a regular basis, more so than what it might have been on a one-off thing. Because a lot of people, when I speak to them initially on intake or when I look through blood work for people, they'll often say, oh, I went to the doctor and they said it was fine. I'd like to know from you guys who actually do this on a more regular basis, if you know, and do you track your blood pressure regularly? not known attract Robert. 125 over 80. It's good blood. That's good blood pressure. We worked on that, Jody. I remember that. Paul, 130 over 85. Creeping up, right? You'd want blood pressure. When we think of gold standard, when we look at blood pressure, we want it at about 120, the top number. So somewhere between 115 to 120 is most likely the safest number. Austin, 132 over 69, similar. That's the kind of number that we want. We want it to be a little bit lower than that. And Henry, when we look at something like 110 over 70, that's what you regard as gold standard in regards to blood pressure. Okay. All right. So most people are here. Nice to see you, Jeff. Thompson, I believe that's you in there in the background under TK.
Yep, that's me.
My man. So I've done these presentations 100 times now, but I can't remember the button for some reason to put it on full screen. So we'll have to keep it like this. So like I said, with cardiovascular disease, it is most likely as men the thing that's going to take us. So I want to make sure that we understand all the mechanisms that can play into cardiovascular disease. I also want to touch on things briefly, and we won't go this into super amounts of detail because I don't want to bore you guys with all the mechanisms at play when we think about cardiovascular disease. But we will look at some of the biology of how this gets initiated for people. So we also get stuck in two arrows, bottom right, full screen, my man. Yes, that's changed. I swear it was never like that before. Lost my train of thought there. So we will touch on the mechanistically how it actually happens. So how does our blood vessels, our veins, our arteries, our blood, our capillaries actually get damaged, and how that initiates the cascade that can lead to cardiovascular disease in the vast majority of us. So I know when you guys will see this all the time, and the battle, the argument is still ongoing. LDL, ApoB, whichever way you want to look at this molecule, is it the thing that causes cardiovascular disease? And I'll pull back and we'll have that discussion in a little bit. And I think it is nuanced, right? And there are certain factors where LDL plays a huge role within cardiovascular disease. And there's some situations where most guys can get away with slightly elevated LDL predominantly and not be a dramatic issue throughout their lifespan. And we'll talk about that as we go on. So we'll talk about what it actually is. We'll have a little bit of a recap in regards to how it actually occurs. And then we'll talk about all the different mechanisms that tend to cause damage to our cardiovascular system. We'll talk about some of the unknown factors. And then we'll talk on some of the factors that we can use to help correct it. Now, as I started to go through this presentation and create it, I realized it's such a big topic that a lot of the things that we can do to correct it, I may have to do on a different presentation, but I'll get through some of that stuff today. So, this isn't Ben's quote, he just came up on the slides. So, like, what is cardiovascular disease in general? You can think about it as four entities, right? You can think about coronary arterial disease. You can think about as cerebrovascular disease, which is more brain-centric. Then you can think of peripheral arterial disease, which is when we have issues in the extremities, so poor blood flow or poor return of blood flow in the lower leg. And then we can think of aortic atherosclerosis. Now, with all of these taken into consideration, I just kind of branch these into all when I just say cardiovascular disease. Okay. So I won't be dealing with all of these individually. We will talk about some symptoms in regards to cardiovascular disease that we may not know, but that's kind of how it's classed. I just wanted to touch on that initially. And I thought this was a brilliant quote. We all refer to ourselves in chronological age, right? So I'm Greg, I'm 38 years old. Everybody refers to themselves in that way. But Thomas Sydenham, who was an English physician, often spoke about a man is only as old as his arteries are. our outside presentation is very much determined by the quality of our cardiovascular system. So if you don't know some of these metrics that we go through today, like when people say like they don't, like I know you mentioned it, Robert, like I'm not sure in terms of blood pressure, or some of you guys mentioned, oh, my blood pressure is 130, 135 over whatever diastolic number. Those things have to be corrected for overall health. Now, what affects the cardiovascular system? We're going to go through a load of stuff today. We need to understand the vast majority of these stuff will not be a reason for all of you. Like you don't have to look all these things. I'll discuss it when we get down to the nitty-gritty a little bit, and you can look at this as an entire picture and think, right, what are the major things within the cardiovascular system that is actually a problem for me and that I know about? Okay, so we can see all these different factors, and I'll touch on a few of them. So we'll come back to lipid particles. So the amount of LDL within your bloodstream and how much of that is oxidized or how much of that has been damaged does play a role. And it is not often, is not something that we should neglect, but it needs to be taken in context with all these other markers that also play a role. Hormone deficiency is something that's often not spoken about. So low levels of testosterone can actually lead to cardiovascular events as well. We won't touch on autoimmunity. Elevated insulin is one of the primary reasons is how we accumulate plaque. So for the guys who know, who here knows their HbA1c? So their marker of blood sugar over 120 days. John, I know you do. If you know it and you're willing to share it, drop it in the chat. So we have to understand that when we look at blood sugar as a marker, it doesn't have to be at pre-diabetic or diabetic ranges to cause cardiovascular or, in certain circumstances, brain damage. I don't mean brain damage as it is in a disease, but damage to the brain, right? We know now that when HbA1c at 5.8 is generally regarded as pre-diabetic, depending on what country you're in. Sometimes it's 5.9, sometimes it's 6, right? We know this is pre-diabetic ranges. From 5.4 up to those, we notice that there's cardiovascular risk factors start to increase, and we know that neurological risk factors start to increase as well. So we have like gold standards that we like to pursue in regards to things like blood sugar, in regards to insulin levels. So looking at those things, not just within the ranges that Doc gives us, but actually within these optimal ranges that research tells us makes the most healthy organism is really, really important. Hypertension, probably the biggest lifestyle factor that we can control. Okay, so this needs to be something that we address. If your blood pressure is between 130 over and 40, although not thought of as primary hypertension, you are starting to come into problems. As we, for every 10 points that our blood pressure goes above 120, we lose somewhere between 5 to 10-ish years of our life. Okay, that's relatively significant over last, no, 5 to 7.5 years, excuse me. That's really significant as we start to get into the 140s to 150s of blood pressure. Okay, we can be knocking 30 years, 15 years, 22 years off our life with hypertension levels like that. We know things like this, like especially for us guys who are desk bound, we have to be specifically intentional about movement. Sedentary lifestyle plays a huge role here. Oxidative stress, we won't touch on. Medication, polypharmacy. On multiple medications, your likelihood of dying from all causes dramatically increases. This is something that's often neglected. So when we look at the mechanisms and some of the mech when we look, sorry, when we look at the mechanisms that play into cardiovascular disease, the microbiome is often a neglected one. They're finding now, even we'll touch on later, in terms of dental health really plays a role in cardiovascular health and brain health. And the microbiome is also another one. When we see this calcification within the arteries, they find bacteria from the gut and bacteria from both the stomach and the large intestine lodged within these calcified plaques. So we know that they can contribute to calcification, and we know they cause some of that systemic inflammation that can damage our lining. fat levels, sedentary lifestyle put in twice for some reason. Homocysteine, which one is one of the genetic issues, which we'll talk a little bit about later. Toxic chemicals is a tricky one, right? For a lot of the guys, when we think about our exposure to whether that's arsenic, lead, mercury, these things in high amounts genuinely dramatically affect our cardiovascular system, similar to air pollution, similar to pathogens we know about smoking, and the blends of fats that we eat tend to play a role. So prostaglandins, you can think of, some of you guys may have heard the idea of like our omega-6 versus omega-3 balance. So omega-6 being thought of as slightly more pro-inflammatory, omega-3 thought about as being more anti-inflammatory. We need both of these in adequate amounts to mount an inflammatory response, but also to resolve it. So when we have an imbalance within these, it can actually cause significant issues around inflammation and cardiovascular risk. Now, we're obviously going to touch on in a second what actually happens when calcification occurs. But what I wanted to ask you guys quickly, who actually here has ever done a coronary calcium score? Or something similar. There's fancier ones now, like Lively, or I think it's Lively it's called. No, nobody. So, coronary calcium
You had
scores.
me do something that was similar that I went in for like an ultrasound of the carotid artery.
Yeah, that's right, John. You did it. So when we look at a coronary calcium score, especially for us guys who are approaching 40 or who are above 40, I think about myself a little bit more in this, who lived a very fun lifestyle in my 20s. If we start to accumulate coronary calcium, it will continue to accumulate relatively quickly if the reason for its accumulation hasn't been addressed. So coronary calcium will tell us if we're starting to get any sort of calcification within our arteries. If you guys are in the States, it actually costs peanuts. It's like in some of the states, it's like $50. It's definitely worth doing, and gives you good indication if you've already done damage. For some of you guys who are walking around with elevated like LDL, for example, it's a really, really cool way to know, at least where you are now, if that LDL is causing you any problems. Okay, so definitely something that you guys should do. Does anybody know any visible symptoms of cardiovascular disease or cardiovascular progression? So, what would you tend to see in people?
They die.
Yeah, well, actually, it's actually really important to know things like that, because sometimes you find that the first sign of cardiovascular risk is a heart attack, and it's not so bad now. This was statistics, I believe, about 10, 15 years ago, that 50% of those people may die, right? So the first sign can genuinely be death. I think for the vast majority, I mean, in terms of like the ability to be able to treat those things now are so much better, that percentage quite well have dropped. So yes, death is definitely one of them.
Does circulation get impacted? Like if your
Big
heart's not
one.
functioning properly?
So really big one. So Shaw's mentioned that numbness and discoloration in extremities. I'm going to come back to that one. That's a really good one. Swollen ankles. Well done, John. Edema. Yeah.
Yeah, I think anything related to perfusion, like typically like hypoperfuse, they can start throwing clots, particularly like deep vein thrombosis and stuff like that. And they get sick really fast.
Right. So like DVT may not be the first sign, but DVT is really common in its progression. So when we start to look at, you mentioned like hypoperfusion, that is a really big factor. And people don't notice that. You'll become people watchers when you start recognizing these symptoms, especially if you're regularly by the pool or by the beach and you look at people's feet, you look at people's calves, and you notice like whether it's discoloration in toenails, whether it's the loss of hair in the lower leg, whether it's almost a shiny skin or a thinning skin that tends to occur in the lower extremities. whether it's varicose veins, whether it's spider veins. These are all signs of poor perfusion to the extremities. But number one symptom that people often neglect, and this is not something you're able to see in anyone else, but one of the major symptoms tends to be erectile dysfunction. So I didn't touch on erectile dysfunction throughout this presentation, but it is one of the first signs of poor perfusion throughout the body. Can't get blood flow to the extremities. Gents always tend to lean towards testosterone. So they think, oh, testosterone is my problem. I can't get it up like I used to. But first and foremost, it's a nitric oxide problem. Okay, worth noting. Any questions so far before I go back to it? We good? Shout out if you need to. Was just Googling coronary calcium score in Australia, about 1500. Yeah, wait till you go to the States. It's like £600 here. So, like, it's expensive here. And it's not every state you can get it for that cheap, but I have seen it in some. You can just get walk-ins, $50.
Greg, real quick, could you touch on briefly exposure to heavy metals, things like lead, for example, and how exactly the actual pathway where they inhibit cardiovascular function?
Well, they'll directly damage endothelial lining, which I'll touch on in a second. So first of all, it can directly cause damage to endothelial lining. They cause oxidation of LDL in of themselves, so they'll damage the LDL particles, and they tend to increase blood pressure. So three mechanisms predominantly. They can also get lodged in tissue, they can get lodged in brain, which plays a role, but predominantly they would be the main things that it would do damage wise mechanistically. Now, so when we look at actually how this happens, and I'm going to blow through this quickly because we're actually already nearly at half past, nothing can happen. This isn't quite 100% true, but it's almost true. Nothing can happen unless there's an initiation of inflammation and endothelial dysfunction. When I say endothelial dysfunction, you can think of the lining of our cardiovascular system. I believe they're like columnar cells. I think I'm right when I say that. So they're just single cells stacked on top of each other because they have to be what's called like semi-permeable. So they have to be able to open and close in certain circumstances. But what tends to happen for a lot of us is we'll get some sort of inflammatory response, whether that be from, like I touched on, heavy metals. I'll show like a little bit of a presentation here. I don't want to go too much into it, but like whether it be dyslipidemia, so high triglycerides can damage it, cigarette smoke, diabetes, hypertension will do damage to this endothelial. And will allow it to become not selectively permeable, but almost permanently permeable. So when this happens, LDL then can actually squeeze in between and get into the matrix and the space behind it. Now, because LDL isn't supposed to be there, it will inevitably get oxidized. This is where damage tends to start to occur. Now, in the majority of circumstances here, we'll get an immune response. So macrophages will come in, they'll engulf it, and they'll normally be able to take it out of circulation. But when this happens over long periods of time, we notice that like these macrophages then turn into foam cells, which turn into which will then go through apoptosis or cell death and turn into these like cell debris, and lysosomal enzymes will accrue that'll accrue this like fibrous cap and it will start to solidify. So then we see that the arteries start to thin. Okay. Now, oxidized LDL is something that we can track in terms of a blood test. And there's lots of things like LPPLA2 and these different markers we can test now, which gives us an idea of the vulnerability of these plaques. But a coronary calcium score will give you actually a good idea if you've started to develop some of this calcification. So I think it's really worth noting when we get into the LDL argument, yes, excessively high LDL is a problem. Don't underestimate that. But there has to be some sort of underlying damaging mechanism that causes damage before LDL in of itself can cause damage. Now, sheer number of LDL can cause this damage by itself. So don't underestimate what damage excessively high amounts can do, but in and of itself should not be mechanistically a problem. Okay. That's just a little bit of an idea. Now, we touched on this already. What is your blood pressure? If your blood pressure is above 130, number one lifestyle factor that you can start to affect to have a more positive cardiovascular outcome, get your blood pressure lower. We can touch on ways to do that. Like aerobic work is probably the most effective way in terms of training modalities. Stress reduction obviously plays a huge role. Any way that we can increase, and I don't go into too much detail in this conversation, any way that we can increase perfusion or increase nitric oxide will be of benefit here. So nitrates from vegetables, for example, they turn into nitrites. And then will increase nitric oxide within the bloodstream. For example, pycnogenol, some of these supplements can be particularly effective at increasing nitric oxide. You'll see stuff like Neo40 out there can be particularly effective, and sometimes high potassium. Yeah, this is, I wasn't necessarily going to touch on this per se, but it's good nudge from Austin. This is why some people are starting to use like low dose Cialis. Like Cialis was initially used to for like erectile dysfunction because it inhibits the breakdown of ENOS or of nitric oxide. So it with low dose Cialis, it obviously doesn't give you the same arousal effect, but it will increase nitric oxide. I remember when people started doing this, thinking to myself, right, what's the long-term problem here? And there isn't a whole bunch that I could find. So it seems to be an appropriate way if we can't control blood pressure otherwise through lifestyle. So the one that's highest in nitrates or nitrites is beetroot, but cruciferous vegetables in general. Radish seems to be pretty high. Arugula, as you guys call it, tends to be pretty high, but generally just combination, right, in terms of vegetables. I'm not going to go through this, but like internally, so we talked on a lot of the outside mechanisms that can play a really big role in cardiovascular disease. But like in terms of internally within us, what stuff can actually dramatically affect it? And mitochondria lies at the center of the vast majority of disease in some capacity. So like poor energy production is really big and one of the major reasons for cardiovascular disease. We touched on like gastrointestinal reasons. So even when we look at like infections like H. pylori, so H. pylori is relatively common. 50% of us have some of it, and then a lot of people tend to overgrow. It's a an infection that tends to stem in the stomach. These things can burrow down through and get into the cardiovascular system and do significant damage. Same with some infections like elevated E. coli. With Viagra, I don't think it was high blood pressure. I think it was something else, but it was definitely a completely different mechanism, to obviously what it worked for. And they obviously thought, jackpot, we figured it out. Now, traumatic brain injury can also be an issue around cardiovascular disease because when we get dysregulation within the brain, we can get uncontrolled blood pressure in some of those circumstances. We spoke about insulin, blood sugar regulation, fat cells in of themselves. If you're carrying excessive body fat, those fat cells will spit out like cytokines. They'll spit out endocrine signaling directly from the fat cells that can damage our cardiovascular system. Most of us in here will probably know that excessive amounts of fat is not good for us. And then I didn't go into too much detail on this for you guys, but reproductive hormones, thyroid function, these things all play a role. Now, some of the things for you guys, and some of this I know is going to be bummer, right? But I'm going to do it anyway. Some of the things that you don't know about that play into cardiovascular health. One of them is what are called HCAs. So heterocyclic amines that predominantly will get from cigarette smoke. We know don't smoke, easy. But some of the other things are like highly polluted areas. There are websites online where you can actually go and check your area and see if it is heavily polluted. I know like some of you guys based in like the Far East in particular, when if or even if you look at like China and some of these countries or India, heavily polluted cities, it can actually be a real big issue. But and in those circumstances, you look at air filtration in the rooms that you spend your most time in. But one of the other major reasons for HCAs and the accumulation of them is barbecuing your food. How many of you guys excessively barbecue your food? We had this discussion actually, didn't we, Henry? Yeah, excessive amounts, like that sound, and like I said, it would, when I was talking with Henry about his genetics earlier, and I was like, you know that sound where you put like that steak on the barbecue, and it's like, tss, and he's like, yeah, that's the sound, right? But that is that accumulation of HCAs and advanced glycated end products. Using that excessively is actually quite damaging, both to our DNA and to our cardiovascular system. Now, there is ways that we can bypass that a little bit, so you can marinate your meat in sorry, Rob. You can marinate your meat in certain herbs, spices, which will protect it quite a lot. Dark beer randomly will lower the amount of HCAs by about 80 to 90%. So there is certain ways that you can offset this. Rosemary, thyme in particular seem to be effective, or the incorporation of vegetables with it that are slightly more protective against the damages of HCAs. But for you guys who barbecue regularly, it doesn't mean the odd time when you're at a party or whatever it may be, but this stuff is one of the other things that seems to play a major role. How many of you guys, when's the last time you went to the dentist, or how many of you guys go regularly? Yeah, you all should be going to the dentist regularly. You're all grown men. Don't skip the dentist. But 6 monthly. But so periodontal disease. In certain case studies, I've never seen it. Now, personally, most of the guys who come through Muscle Intelligence generally look after their teeth, right? You're all vain as fuck. So you look after your teeth, you look after how you look. But for there is case studies out there showing periodontal disease and the particular bacteria within it as a central component to cardiovascular disease. So, like both Fusobacterium and gingivitis, the bacteria gingivitis, they can burrow down into the gums and actually get into the cardiovascular disease and do direct damage to the lining of your cardiovascular system, and they also play a big role in brain health. So, knowing if you have infections is really, really important. Yeah, she knows, obviously. But yeah, so like taking that stuff seriously is obviously very, very important. And then one of the other things that we're going to touch on predominantly in this call is genetics, right? So genetics can actually be one of the factors as to the reason why we get cardiovascular disease when we've done all the other stuff right. How many guys Henry went through today? John, I've done yours. How many else? How many other guys? I know Jody, I've done yours. Have done your genetics so far? Yeah, nice. So we can get really clear indications of other risk factors from genetics, and I'll touch on a few of these with you guys. Whether you find this interesting or not. So when we spoke about circadian rhythms, how we sleep, how we eat, and how it leads into cardiovascular risk, you can see that the accumulation of, now, this is association, let's be really clear on that. The accumulation of light pollution and the density of light pollution within certain areas directly correlates with the amount of cardiovascular events in that area. So, following your circadian rhythm is really important. We're not going to touch on this too much, right? But looking at some of the lifestyle factors that tend to be ignored, several studies have shown associations of sleep and autonomic dysfunction with major surrogate markers of atherosclerosis, such as carotid, intima media thickness, and arterial stiffness in those who don't sleep appropriately. Exercise, we know. Stress. I hate using the word stress because it almost seems from our side like it's a cop out, right? But the inability to be able to tolerate stress. So we can't remove the vast majority of the stressors from your lives. You're all going to have work stress. You all have family stress. A lot of you guys have kids. That stuff can't be removed, but our resiliency to stress can be trained. But I thought this was like even just the name of this particular paper I found particularly interesting. So it's like chronic stress is a potential suspect zero for atherosclerosis. So we can talk about mechanisms and, these underlying issues in diet if we don't correct for stress, not the removal of stress, correct for it. It can actually be one of these underlying factors. How many people knew that? Loneliness is a better predictor of death than smoking and alcohol consumption. So, and it's important to recognize with loneliness that it is perception. It's got nothing to do with actually being alone. People who live alone and don't have many friends but have purpose in life, whether that's God, whether that's their job, whether that's their, or that kind of says vocation, loneliness plays a huge role. So community is huge. Those who, I always use church as an example here, and I was speaking this actually with clients earlier, those who are involved in church and believe in a higher being live significantly longer and happier lives than those who don't. So community seems to play a major role here in cardiovascular health and how long we live. We're not going to go through chemicals as well. It's a lot to think about. But so for you guys, what do you think are some of the compounding factors that you can target when you look at cardiovascular disease? Because we just went through so much different stuff. What do we think it is? Yeah, they do take a while. So, anybody have something from that list of things they think they can work on for themselves or find out for themselves?
Yeah, Greg, one of the things we were talking about earlier, I know for myself and like general stress levels is like looking at particular moments throughout the day where I can typically just where I'm in a more like parasympathetic state for no reason, and trying to be more mindful. So specifically we were talking about like eating meals. I know right now I'm on a deficit meal plan, so it can be pretty easy to get worked up. It's like you're putting the final thing together for your meal, sit down and then just wolf it down. So, and that I have found leads to like greater stress throughout the day, not to mention you just like stuff your face. So, being more intentional in those moments and paying attention to what those moments are throughout your day. So for me, like just trying to slow down before I actually like have a meal or something like that.
Yeah, I think like I think that's quite profound in a way, because you can think about like micro meditation, right? So like people always think about like meditation or breath work as having to be these big exaggerated events where you sit in dark rooms and do the thing. But like just having moments throughout the day to recognize the state of your nervous system, I think is really important. So for a lot of us, we just go through life on autopilot. We just do without being intentional with a lot of the things that we do. So finding those moments throughout the day, whether that's with food, whether that is like between calls, whether that is on your way to work or on your way home from work before you come home to see family, I think they can be effective ways. Jeff, sleep. Yeah, sleep's big for a lot. Exposures, water's an interesting one, right? Like we do get a lot of exposure to different chemicals and certain heavy metals when we drink standardized water. It also depends on the area that you're in, but filtered water seems to play a big role here. Yeah, big time. Home blood pressure. Nice, Robert. It's easy. Like once you do it regularly, you'll know where it should be. Yeah, you, because you were at six initially, weren't you, John? And it's just slowly been creeping down slowly, which is great. So we'll get you down below 5.4. That's the goal. There you go. Highest was 6.8. So that's great. So Think about the things that you can do from that list that's actionable now. So whether it is stress, whether it's water exposure, whether it is like elevated HbA1c like John had in the past, what is the major thing that you can target to protect your cardiovascular system? And then we can look at some of the genetic stuff. So I'm only going to go through a handful of genes here. We could go through a load of different ones. Yeah. We already discussed that in terms of scores. You all should have at some stage, especially for you guys in the States, get a coronary calcium score. Like you should, the goal for all of you is zero, right? Now, genetics of cardiovascular disease. Who has heard of ApoE? So ApoE is a gene often associated. Yeah, 4.73 is great HbA1c, Thompson. Fasting glucose when you go to a doctor, I don't think is very accurate, and also you're bulking, so you'll have a slightly elevated blood sugar. ApoE is a marker of often associated with neurodegeneration. So ApoE is a enzyme that attaches to all your LDL in the body and helps it as a transporter, but it acts as a really potent antioxidant as well and helps protect the LDL from damage. But what we can get in certain circumstances is we lose some of the we get like cysteine residues that sit on top of them, but in some gene types we lose these cysteine residues and they act very protective. So when we lose those, we tend to be able to do more damage to these LDLs, and also we tend to release more and we reuptake less. So when people have this gene type, then I actually want to make sure their lipids are under control, right? So like I was talking about earlier, I don't always care about elevated LDL as long as all the other markers are under control. If I see this, lipids need to be controlled. Okay, so when ApoE is elevated in those circumstances, we definitely try and target it. This, when you get, there's two different types. So you've got ApoE 3/4 and ApoE 4/4. 3/4 increases your likelihood of neurodegeneration by 2 to 3 times. ApoE 4/4 increases the likelihood by 12 to 15 times. So it's really significant. But there's loads of lifestyle interventions now that you can do to protect yourself when you have this gene type. But you never know unless you check it. So that's why when you're doing all the other stuff, like I'm not that keen on seeing people's genetics if I don't have blood tests, if I don't know their lifestyle, if they're not doing all the other stuff right. Genetics, most of the time, there's still certain genes I'd like to see, like this one, but most of the time, I don't care what your genes look like if you're not doing the other stuff right. But when you're doing all the other stuff and you're getting everything right, these are definitely very, very important. So ApoE is one of them. LP little A is becoming. It's actually starting to hit the mainstream a little bit more now, which is great. Again, it's associated with LDL. It attaches to LDL in your body, not every single one, and it travels around the body with your LDL. But one of the things that this can do, it's particularly atherogenic. And then atherogenic just means it damages your cardiovascular system. It either damages the LDL or it damages the walls and is, again, one of those real independent risk factors. This is one of those genes that when people are what are called homozygous, meaning you got the gene from both parents, dramatically increases risk of cardiovascular disease, heart attacks, all these things. And it, even in people who are super healthy and they go to get a coronary calcium score at 45 and 50, and they find it at 500, 600, and they're asking themselves why. Now, positive signs, there's lifestyle factors, supplementation that they can actually control this for the most part. In 5 years, there'll be a drug to knock this out. So LP little A is definitely one of those ones that you want to check. Some of you guys may have heard of this. Who has heard of? Speaks about quite a lot, like Gary Brecka. You see out there quite a lot, become quite famous online. He's a bit of a prick, but he talks about MTHFR a lot. with something like methylation like this, methylation is a huge biochemical pathway that does all the sorts of these fancy things. Like it helps us break down histamine, it helps us produce neurotransmitters, it helps us break down that their head is as a mother, the motherfucker gene. So like it breaks down histamine, it creates neurotransmitters, it helps to break down neurotransmitters, it creates creatine, it creates phosphatidylcholine, it does all these really, really fancy things. But for cardiovascular system wise, it helps to recycle something called homocysteine. He is absolutely a snake oil salesman. But it helps to recycle something called homocysteine. Now, homocysteine we can check, okay? So we can check homocysteine on a blood test, so we can get real life feedback on whether this gene type is a problem for you. So it is important to know, because homocysteine, like the other two, like Lp(a), like ApoE, is an independent risk factor. Because methylation, in a byproduct way, is also responsible for our production of nitric oxide. So knowing if you are MTHFR, 677, heterozygous, homozygous, these things can give really clear indication and help to know, make sure that your cardiovascular system is in perfect health. But also, when you look at some of the other stuff, like, I'm not going to go too far with the other genetic things, but like what the other stuff that methylation does outside of just heart health, it's really profound. It's really big. And I think I have. Yes. So ENOS, or endothelial nitric oxide synthase. ENOS is the enzyme that helps us to produce, or does produce, nitric oxide. And I know I mentioned nitric oxide a bunch in this call, didn't really discuss what it was, but it does lots of different things. But at a basic level, when we think cardiovascular health, it creates vasodilation within our arteries to allow blood to run freely. When we have SNPs within ENOS, we see downregulation in that nitric oxide production. So we need to find effective ways to either increase the efficiency of it, or give it support in some capacity to make sure that we get enough blood flow as we go through life. Like, even what people might find interesting is, like, direct sunlight actually increases both ENOS production and our endogenous nitric oxide production away from this enzyme. So sunlight can be a particular way that you can affect this. But they're the four. There is a lot of other genes, but they're the four main genes that tend to concern me when I look at people's cardiovascular health. There's loads of other ones associated with high blood pressure and other things, but they are kind of, call them the keystone ones. I think that's all it is. So that's all from me talking wise. Like I said, we'll go through, and I will make it for our next call that I'm on. I'll think of like all the solutions for not all of these things, but for the majority of these things. For today, before we finish, have you guys got any questions on any of that stuff that we went through? Or any questions in regards to anything? It doesn't necessarily have to be a cardiovascular disease.
Was interested on you said you were going to touch on the numbness and discoloration in your extremities. Was interested in what you had to say about that.
What are the so like when we in terms of solutions?
Solutions are, mostly solutions.
Yeah, so when we look at like ways or effective ways to increase blood flow to the extremities, when we think of lifestyle things or activity things, cold plunge and particularly heat exposure does it. So why heat exposure directly? It tends to increase vasodilation, but also in response to the sun, that'll increase nitric oxide directly. Also, when you eat nitrates and nitrites from vegetables, will increase nitric oxide production. Stuff like hawthorn extract, ginkgo biloba, and stuff like huperzine A will also increase vasodilation to the extremities. But getting cardio work and aerobic work as well is particularly effective at doing it. There's some things that you can start with if you're noticing it. Some of the like peptides that tend to work surprisingly. I remember I had a client with Raynaud's, so like his fingers were going blue. Now I didn't use it for that, but it did actually really work. BPC 157 seems to really work at increasing angiogenesis and blood flow to the extremities.
Interesting. Okay.
I like the mechanistically, I was really surprised when the blueness went away in his fingers, and I was like, "What did we do?" Because I wasn't targeting that directly. He had other problems, and yeah, it seemed to have a lot of effect. But I would definitely lean towards cold exposure and heat exposure and aerobic work.
Thank you.
Anybody else? No, we good. Zone two tends to be better because it's a volume thing, right? So when we look at like circulation, it seems to be a volume thing. So aerobic work would be a little bit better. For like as long as you can. Okay, if we got nothing else, gents, I'll let you guys get on with your Chew Wednesday evening. Thank you all very, very much, and I will speak to you all soon.
Awesome. Thanks, Greg.
Thanks, guys.